Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast, an audio-guided walk featuring many of London's untold, unsolved and long-forgotten murders, all set within and beyond the West End. Today's episode is about the hunt for the murderer of Alice Gross. With rape as a motive, but no clear link to any suspect, the attack seemed almost random. And although their encounter was entirely by chance, a cruel twist of fate may have decided her death just 3 years before she was even born. Murder Mile is researched using authentic sources. It contains moments of satire, shock, and grisly details. And as a dramatization of the real events, it may also feature loud and realistic sounds, so that no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael. I am your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 121. The Yellow Ribbons of Hanwell, Part 2. Today, I'm standing on Castle Bar Road in Ealing, W5. 4 miles west of the flat, shared by the killers of Vincent Patrick Carey. 3 miles northwest of the Chiswick Cat Ladies. 1 street northwest of the newsagents where the sadistic Polish rapist Andrei Karnowski lured his penultimate victim. And 1.5 miles southeast of the bloodbath at Gurnall Grove. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Ealing is one of the borough's 7 towns, including Acton, Greenford, Perivale, Northolt, Southall, and on its westerly border is Hanwell. As a settlement since the Iron Age, Ealing comes from the Saxon word Gilligas, which fittingly means place of the people, being a nice place to live and work. Skirting north of Ealing Broadway sits Castlebar, a B road heading to Hanwell. As a residential street, shoehorned full of townhouses, terraces, flats and care homes, it's the kind of place where everyone is pleasant to one another. In passing, they may nod, wave, and utter a cheery, "How do you do?" Only to dart inside, pry open the curtains, and lambast their partner, as after a decade of niceties, the worst crime of all would be the shame of asking their neighbour, "I'm sorry, but what is your name?" Halfway up the hill, opposite a little V-shaped patch of grass called Tortoise Green, sits 42 Castlebar Road. A 3-storey, semi-detached, light brown house, with large white windows, a black iron fence, and like so many overpriced London houses, it was subdivided into several rented flats. Today it's a lovely home, which I'm assured houses some thoroughly pleasant persons. But just 7 years ago, the basement flat was rented out to a builder with a baby, a bride-to-be, and a bicycle. And although hard-working, none of the residents knew about his deadly past or his sadistic obsession. as far as we know. Its tenant never knew Alice. She never knew him. And although, as he cycled home from work, the murder of a young girl might not have been on his mind. In a chance encounter, there may have been something oddly familiar about Alice, which stirred his emotions and drove him to kill. As it was here, on Thursday the 4th of September 2014, exactly 1 week after her disappearance, that 41-year-old Anna Selkins vanished, leaving behind a family and taking one more life. Missing for 4 days, Rosalind made an appeal to her daughter. We'd like to say to Alice that we miss her, we love her, and that she's not in any trouble. All we want to know is that she's safe. Being a grounded girl, Alice's only vices were walks, pets, and music. She avoided conflict, strangers, unsafe settings, and she didn't keep any secrets. As having opened her heart to her family about her battle with depression and anorexia, their love and support had kept her strong. She had never run away from home, but every option had to be considered, even the unthinkable. And although her family and the people of Hanwell never lost hope, as the streets were radiated by blooms of bright yellow ribbons in a vigil to find Alice, as time eroded, the likelihood of finding her alive grew more distant. If someone had taken her, the question was who and why. On day 5, having found her black backpack and trainers hidden amongst a dense thicket on a remote river towpath, although it remained a missing persons case until the evidence suggested otherwise, it was escalated to Detective Superintendent Carl Metta of the Met Police's Serious Crime Command. Conducting one of London's largest searches, hundreds of dogs and officers scoured 10 square miles of dense, impenetrable woodland. Overgrown, unmapped, and riddled with dank nooks and recesses. From Three Bridges to Brentford Lock, the River Brent to the Hanwell Flight, covering every conceivable spot from Trumpers Way to Gallows Bridge and Boston Manor Park. As divers waded through 3.5 miles of unnavigable rivers, ponds and bogs, relying mostly on touch amidst its silty depths. Over the coming weeks, a jigsaw of CCTV footage would painstakingly rebuild a timeline of Alice's last known movements. And yet, it would yield very few clues to her whereabouts, as at that very crucial moment, between 4:23 p.m. and 4:42 p.m., her digital history had a dead zone. It seemed impossible. How could a young girl, with a very identifiable look, outfit and walk, vanish from a moderately busy towpath on a summer's day in broad daylight, and yet nobody saw a thing? As a senior detective, DSI Carl Metta had been investigating this as a potential homicide, looking for any anomalies and potential suspects. On Saturday the 6th of September at 5 p.m, a 25-year-old Ealing man was arrested but later bailed. And on Sunday the 7th, after a tip-off, a 51-year-old local man was arrested after a shovel, ropes and sacks were found in the boot of his car. But he was later released uncharged. Alice hadn't vanished of her own volition. That much was clear, so somebody had to know something. But even before these arrests were made, DSI Metta had a second line of inquiry and a suspect. On average, 55,000 people go missing in London every year, with roughly 33 missing persons reported in the borough of Ealing every week. And that week was no different. Excluding Alice, to the DSI, this list was a typical mix of the borough's most vulnerable, whether children, the elderly, or the mentally distressed, many of whom would return home safe and well. But one person's details stood out. On Friday the 5th of September, a 41-year-old Latvian was reported missing by his girlfriend. His passport and bank accounts lay untouched. Both his UK and Latvian phones were dead. CCTV had lost him one day earlier. And as a new dad, with a good job and a baby daughter, he had no reason to vanish. Last seen cycling away from his basement flat at 42 Castlebar Road, his disappearance had eerie similarities to Alice. Only he wasn't the victim, but the prime suspect. And his name was Arnis Zalkins. Little is known about his early years, except for a few scant details. And although his family would later state he was a good man who wouldn't hurt anyone, especially a child, his past would refute this. Physically, he was unremarkable, being neither hideous, handsome, nor bland. As an average-looking man of 5'10" tall, slightly stocky, and 13 stone in weight, he mirrored many other welders in the dockyard. He was practical, good with his hands, and had the skills to construct his own tools. With a jutting chin, piercing grey eyes, and a brown ponytail, he was semi-successful in his pursuit of petite young ladies. And although moderately charming, his overriding character was aggression. In the spring of 1994, in a Riga nightclub, Arnis met 19-year-old seamstress, Rudita Zalkins. With soft brown hair, pale skin, and a pixie-ish nose, there was something prepubescent about her elfin features and doll-like figure. As if, being a little naive, her mind and body remained as a little girl. And easily enchanted, ignoring her mother's warnings, she fell madly in love and quickly fell pregnant. By December 1994, hiding her bulging belly under a pink maternity dress, Arnis and Rudita married, with their daughter Elvira born just 2 months later. But life was far from bliss, as Arnis was cruel, abusive, and controlling. With the cause uncertain, whether Rudita had dented his ego having begun a lesbian fling, or stumbled upon his alleged links to the Latvian mafia, the violence she suffered was irrefutable. In 1996, having handmade a low-caliber handgun, with his masculinity impugned, he shot her in the stomach. Surviving with a crushed bullet lodged in her spine, being too terrified to call the police, and with Arnis refusing to pay for a surgeon to remove it, she was stitched back up, and there it remained. By March 1997, with his temper tightly wound, as his wife dared to go out without him or his say-so, feeling paranoid and spurned, he callously prepared her death. Under the ruse of a gift, he lured Rudita to a remote woodland on the outskirts of Riga, where his weapons lay in wait. Wielding a foot-long kosh he had fashioned from a scaffolding pole, he frenziedly bludgeoned this tiny girl to unconsciousness, and brandishing a handmade blade, he stabbed her through the heart. Stripped naked, tied into a fetal position, and stuffed into a bin bag, Arnis dumped her body in a pre-dug 3-foot grave. discarding her clothes and trainers. He disguised the crime scene so that, even to experts, it looked untouched. His planning was detailed, and his execution was faultless. But his failure was his obsession. Rudita was dead and gone, but unable to sleep and being haunted by her face, all he could think about was Rudita. Reporting her missing, detectives found her diary in which she detailed the violence and the despair she suffered. And as the police's prime suspect, on the 9th of July 1997, just 4 months later, he confessed to her murder. So well concealed was his wife's body that Arnis himself had to guide the search teams to her grave. Assessed as mentally stable, he pleaded guilty to murder, and on the 19th of June 1998, he was sentenced to 12 years in Riga Central Prison. On appeal, this was reduced to 8, but he served only 7. Released on probation in 2005, leaving Elvira without a father or a mother, he moved to La Paya, began a new life with a lady called Liga Rabinowitz. They had 2 children, and keen to bury his criminal past, and maybe still unable to let go, he changed his surname from Daxa to Zalkins, the surname of his dead wife. In 2007, Arnis Zalkins, a welder with no previous criminal convictions, boarded a coach from Riga to London, having never been placed on Interpol's watch list of violent offenders. Moving to the West Ealing suburb of Boston Manor, he worked on a building site in Isleworth, cycled his Red Trex mountain bike along the Grand Union Canal, and starting a relationship with his new girlfriend, Katerina Leiblov. They would later move into the basement flat at 42 Castle Bar Road in Ealing, and together they had a daughter called Linda. He had a new life, in a new world, with a new family. Only his old demons were never put to rest. In 2009, triggered by either lust, rage or obsession, Arnis Zalkins was arrested for the sexual assault of a 14-year-old schoolgirl in Boston Manor Park. A densely overgrown woodland, by the towpath on the Hanwell Flight, just 1.5 miles south of Lock 97. And although fully investigated, the terrified girl decided not to proceed, and the charges against him were dropped. For DSI Carl Metter, Arnis Zalkins was his prime suspect. With a history of violence and sexual assault against petite young girls, his physical description and mountain bike matched the footage of the Trumpers Way Bridge, and his DNA matched a sample which had been found on Alice's backpack and her trainer. On Tuesday the 16th of September, DSI Meta took the very unusual step of announcing Zalkins as a person of interest, stating, "We simply want to speak to him, as he may have information that can help in our search for Alice." The next day, police released CCTV footage showing Alice crossing the short black and white footbridge at Brentford Gauging Lock at 3:45 p.m. on the day she disappeared. At 4 p.m, just 15 minutes later, that same footage showed Arnis crossing the footbridge and cycling north up the canal. So why did Arnis attack Alice? He didn't know her. He had never met her. And based on the evidence, it wasn't a premeditated murder. If anything, their contact would be as fleeting as any other stranger they would pass on the towpath that day, with Arnis as one of many anonymous cyclists who were heading home from work, and Alice as just another jogger keeping fit. Thursday the 28th of August 2014, was as unremarkable as any other day that summer. Being 23 degrees, sunny but not hot, and calm with a light breeze, it was the perfect weather for a walk. At 12:50 p.m, with a matching outfit, a confident stride, and a swinging ponytail, Alice left home on a spontaneous walk via an improvised route decided by her mood and energy. Her speed was consistent as she passed the following locations: 1:02 p.m, Hanwell Station; 1:13 p.m, Hanwell Bridge; 1:15 p.m, Uxbridge Road; and 1:26 p.m, she entered Windmill Lane and the Hanwell Flight. She passed Lock 97, The Siphon, Trumpers Way Bridge, Elthorn Park, Austerley Lock, the M4 Flyover, and Boston Manor Park. She crossed over at Gallows Bridge, passed Transport Avenue, the Great Western Road, and at 2:23 p.m, she entered Brentford Gauging Lock, where at 3 p.m, she texted her dad. At no point during her walk south did Arnis see her, as from 9 a.m. that morning, he was on a building site in Isleworth, 3.5 miles south of her home and 1 mile west of Brentford Lock. He worked hard, he took a short break, his mood was good, and he left work at his usual time. At 3:35 p.m, wearing a bluish short-sleeved shirt, cream chinos and black trainers, he cycled east along London Road on his red Trex mountain bike with a black rucksack on his back. Given how meticulously he had planned and executed the murder of his wife, with a pre-dug grave, a handmade cosh, a sharpened knife, a set of cable ties and a roll of black bin bags, as well as how methodically he had hidden her body and disguised the crime scene so it looked untouched, we know his attack on Alice wasn't premeditated prior to this moment, as none of the tools he would need were on his person or at the scene. At 3:45 p.m, Alice headed north across the black and white footbridge of Brentford Lock. At 4 p.m, taking his usual route home, Arnis cycled past that same spot, heading up the canal in the same direction as Alice, as many joggers, dog walkers, and at least 4 of the cyclists would, at roughly that same time. With her walking speed gauged at 3 miles an hour, and his cycling speed at about 8, they would have passed one another on the narrow towpath near to Boston Manor Park, the site of his alleged sexual assault on a 14-year-old schoolgirl. At 4:26 p.m, a camera captured Alice being overtaken by the last of 5 cyclists at the Trumpers Way Bridge. Her speed was steady and she showed no sense of fear, so if Arnis had confronted her near Gallows Bridge, she could have left the canal on this road heading to Hanwell. But she didn't. Having cycled to Lock 97, Arnis stopped, parked up his bike, and just to the left of Lock Cottage, down a secluded and overgrown shortcut running alongside the River Brent, he lit up a Lucky Strike menthol, and as he lay in wait, he smoked it down to the filter. So why Alice? A girl he never knew, had never met, and hadn't a single reason to either love or hate, who was just one of hundreds, if not thousands of girls he had cycled by every day on that stretch of the canal. Well, that we can never know for certain. But there is one immutable and undeniable truth. Alice was a tiny girl, with the wise head of a grown-up, but the small skinny body of a child. Being pixie-ish and petite, with elfin-like features and a doll-like frame, although she was unquestionably easy prey for a 5'10", 13-stone man, Her look bore an uncanny similarity to that of his dead wife. 17 years after Ruditta's murder, still haunted by the face of his long-dead lover, the motive of Arnis Salkins might have been decided in a fleeting glance, from behind and on a bike. As in a cruel ironic twist, the tragic fate of Alice Gross was maybe set in motion 3 years before she was even born. The attack was swift and brazen. It had to be. Being a bright summer's day, he snatched Alice off the public footpath, silenced her lips with his grubby hand, and as he dragged the terrified teen into the bushes, all the while, throughout her ordeal, lines of unwitting people would pass by, just a few feet away. For Arnis, the risk of being discovered was extremely high. But right there, hidden amongst the dense thicket, he raped this little girl, until his 83-kilo bulk crushed the last breath of air from her tiny lungs. Evidence suggests that sex was the motive, not murder. But with Alice's limp and lifeless body slumped beside him, his new motive was her disposal. As he had with his dead wife, he needed to hide her so no one would find her. Ever. Only with no plan, no tools, and no pre-dug grave, he risked arrest. At 5:49 p.m., 75 minutes later, and at about the same time that Alice should have returned home, a camera on the Uxbridge Road caught Arnis emerging from the towpath at Hanwell Bridge. In his bag was stashed her dead iPhone, possibly some of her clothes, and having dumped her backpack along the overgrown shortcut, we know he had entered the river as the legs of his cream chinos were rolled up to his knees. At 7:30 p.m., he left his home. In his rucksack was a shovel, a torch, spare clothes, and a roll of black bin bags. Where he found the 4 house bricks and the broken bicycle wheel is unknown. But this kind of innocent detritus could easily be found at the canal, having been dumped by any lazy fly-tipper. At 7:46 p.m., the Hanwell Bridge camera caught him returning to the scene, where he stayed until 8:49 p.m. Wading chest deep into this isolated and unnavigable bend on the River Brent, he dug a shallow trench in the dark riverbed, and having wrapped her small porcelain body in black bin bags, behind a tree, down a slope, and buried deep in 3 feet of silty water, he disguised this unrecognizable black lump amongst the mud and weighed her down with bricks, sections of tree trunk, and a 20-kilo log. So meticulously had he hidden the body of Alice Gross that she wouldn't be found for 33 days. The next day, that same camera on the Hanwell Bridge captured him at 6:48 a.m. and 9:02 p.m., returning to the scene, possibly to check on the body, as he cycled to and from work along that same towpath. With her black backpack and blue trainers found just 5 days later, that day, his internet search history was dominated by one name, Alice Gross. On Thursday the 4th of September at 12:40 a.m., 1 week after her disappearance, 41-year-old Arnis Salkins left his flat at Castlebar Road, and having packed a rucksack with ropes and tools, he vanished. Announced as a person of interest, a forensic search found additional evidence, including the bin bags, his bike, his clothes, and the cracked case to Alice's iPhone at his home. as well as hours of CCTV footage, the cigarette butt found at the crime scene, and Zelkin's DNA was recovered from her backpack, her canvas trainer, and protected by the waterproof bin bags. His DNA remained on her skin. The police were confident of a conviction. All they had to do was find him. But after 31 days of being missing, Arnis Zelkins was finally found. On Saturday the 4th of October at 2 p.m, in a remote and densely wooded thicket in Boston Manor Park, barely a mile south of Lock 97, the badly decomposed body of Arnis Zelkins was found hanging from a tree. So well disguised was his body that a previous search by police specialists had failed to find it, and with no evidence of third-party involvement, his cause of death was hanging by suicide. The culprit was found, the case was closed, and an inquest was held. But having taken his own life, Arnis Zelkins would never be convicted, and the family of Alice Gross would never get justice. On the 23rd of October 2014, the people of Hanwell stood in silence as a black hearse crawled across Broadway. Illuminated by yellow ribbons, candles and flowers, in the back lay a small yellow coffin, decorated with paintings and designs of everything that Alice loved. But Alice's name was not to become synonymous with grief, but joy. In her brief life, her love of music would become her legacy, a legacy which lasts to this day, and will continue to inspire a new generation of children and teenagers to battle through their personal problems, just as Alice had, and to embrace the things that they love. In her memory, Alice's Youth Music Memorial Fund was established, raising donations and seeking to provide a substantial legacy of music making for disadvantaged children, as well as the Alice Gross Songwriting Award, which inspires a new generation of young songwriters. Alice will forever live in our hearts, with the yellow ribbons of Hanwell once again seen as a symbol of hope. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. That was the concluding part of The Yellow Ribbons of Hanwell. If you'd like to learn a little more about this case, join me for a cup of tea after the break. And to make a donation to Alice's Youth Music Memorial Fund, there is a link in the show notes. But before that, here's a brief promo to a true crime podcast which may be right up your street.
Hello everyone, this is Robin Warder, host of the true crime podcast, The Trail Went Cold. If you grew up watching the classic television show Unsolved Mysteries, then this is the podcast for you. Each week, I profile a new unsolved murder or missing persons case and share all the baffling details. Afterward, I provide my own personal analysis and theories about what might have happened. This is a show for true crime buffs who are fascinated by cold cases and love to discuss them and pick them apart in an attempt to figure out the truth. So be sure to check out our podcast to learn about some truly bizarre unsolved mysteries where the trail went cold.
A big thank you to my new Patreon supporters, many of whom joined us a good few weeks ago, so once again I apologise for the delay. They are Sally Worsley, Jonathan McLean, Shauna Iwasiuk, Elizabeth Whiteley, George Hall, Guido Puddy, Kim Squara, Chris Nero, Shirley Jones, Michelle Wilde-Nigan, Megan Morris, and T. Bilo. With the Patreon competition winners from ages ago being Michael Hanrahan, who won a Murder Mile mug of goodies, and Karen Hillier and Cara Langford, who won a Murder Mile keyring.
Ooh.
Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I don't know why I always look at my script for that end bit. The Murder Mile was researched and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. I've said it like 100-odd times. I know it well. Why do I still look at the script? Oh dear, that was a long record, made even longer because I'm going to take away my sound boom thing. There we go, put that out of the way so I can go to the kitchen in a bit. Made even worse because I've had an eye infection. I've still got a bloody eye infection. Oh, bloody eye infection. Let me go and make a tea and a coffee because it's bloody cold out today. And my cup of coffee went cold quick. Hang on, windows open, doors open because it's very nice outside today. It's a nice clear day, but because I thought it was quite warm last night, so I didn't put a fire on. Therefore, it's all there's a lot of condensation in the boat this morning. So hang on, tea on. Where'd I put my cup? Why am I asking you? I put it there. Right, cup of tea. Tea in, tea bag on, sugar, whoops, there we go, let's do that, oops, sugar in, milk ready, and a little treat as well. Oh, exciting, a little treat. A Mrs. Crimble's macaroon. Ooh! If you haven't had a macaroon before, they're great. They're basically just a biscuit, both nice and soft, made of coconut, and they're very nice. So that's going on the side. It's not Mrs. Crimble's one with the chocolate on the bottom. I thought it was, but it wasn't. But that will do me just fine. Thank you very much. Lovely. So yeah, I've had an eye infection for about 5 days. It's been a real pain in the arse. So I'm a day late recording this because I haven't been able to see the screen. I've still been writing, but it's hard to write when you can't see the screen and your eyes are streaming and you can't sleep and you're snotting everywhere. And it's, I dashed out and bought loads of all this stuff that you're meant to buy that's meant to be like, oh, buy this and it help you with an eye infection. It's like, you know, £8 a go or £10 a go and da da da. You pop it in. And it's like, it's not doing any good. And then I went to the NHS website, which is always a good source of information. And I was like, eye infection. And they went, get some cotton wool and some hot water and just bathe it. That's really helped. I was like, within an hour, I was like, brilliant. Yeah, my eye feels much better. So, it still hurts today, but it's not as bad as it was. So, that's been good. Oh, eye infection and snotting. Brilliant. That's what you've tuned in for. What else we got? Hope everyone's enjoyed. If you haven't subscribed to the Patreon thing, I've set up a new thing recently, which is very exciting. It's called Walk With Me. It's a new episode that goes out every week. It's after I've finished editing, I do a little bit of a walk. You can join me on a walk. I talk about the episode we've just done. I talk about the future episodes. And the last couple of weeks, I've been walking up a track, which people seem to be using for dogging. So there's lots of cars there and lots of flashing of lights. And I always have a little walk up there to see how many people I recognise. Obviously, I don't. So that's all good. Just as a CrimeCon update, everyone, just so you know, we've just had confirmation that because of changes, because of COVID lockdown or changes of dates, the new dates are, as mentioned before, Saturday the 25th and Sunday the 26th of September 2021. So it's cool. Ooh, tease up. Hang on. Hold that thought. Water in. Let that stew. And then by the time I finish talking about CrimeCon, then I'll be done. So that's Saturday the 25th and Sunday the 26th of September. If you've already bought tickets, they will have already announced it for you. This is actually better because I think lockdown restrictions were kind of meant to be tailing away kind of June-ish time. So this is a little bit too close. So the new September date will probably be in a much better place by then. So if you want to buy tickets, go to crimecon.co.uk. As mentioned before, it's the ultimate true crime weekend partnered by the Crime Investigation Channel. You're going to meet loads of detectives there. You're going to meet loads of authors. There's Podcasters Row. I'm going to be there. Come along. Say hello. If you want to get a discounted ticket, go to the website. Type in mile. You get a discount there. It's going to be all good fun. There's going to be loads of us there. And there's me and a couple of other podcasters are doing it's not really a lecture, but a presentation. So that will be good. We're looking forward to that. So please do come and join us. Right. Last week, obviously. Tea stewed. I almost did it then. I almost forgot to grab tea. And of course. Hang on. Popping me powdered milk. Oh, yummy. Look at it. Oh, yummy. Cool. It's like wartime. There you go. I've got my powdered milk. Next up, I'll treat myself to some powdered egg. Some Spam. And I start singing songs by Vera Lynn. There we go. Whoa, remember the good old days. Right, obviously last week we didn't get to do much about the case because I didn't want to ruin what was going to happen with this episode. So I can dive into a lot of it now. This is all good. So as mentioned, Arnis Elkins, real name Arnis Daxa. We don't really know much about his early life. We know his height, his weight, as mentioned, is about 5'10", which is 1.77 metres tall. He was 83 kilos. This is all kind of useful. You would have noticed that I put it into episode one, how much she weighed, how much he weighed, because you need to know that he's more than double her weight. He's 8 inches taller, but he's more than double her weight. She's tiny. He's relatively bulky. So as we saw with the Camden Ripper, again, compression asphyxiation, do you know, rough sex, in this case, rape, causing compression of the lungs, cracking of the lungs, ergo she can't breathe, therefore she dies. There was no one. There didn't seem to be any other wounds to her. It was never mentioned in any of the reports. There was no strangulation there, so it was the cause of death was compression asphyxia. Let's see what we've got. So Rudita Zalkins, his former wife. As mentioned before, if you are a Patreon subscriber, I know I keep waffling on about it, but literally for £2 a month you get a lot of extra goodies with this. I've drawn up maps as well, so you can see, so you can follow the routes. I've taken pictures of all the locations and I'm putting all the back history pictures in there as well, so it's really useful. But you'll get to see a picture of Rudita Zalkins, and when you look at the similarity between Rudita and Alice Scrott, it's kind of uncanny. Do you know, they're both small, they're both petite, they're both elfin life like they've both got kind of a pixie-ish little nose, they've got the same type of hair. You can imagine, you wouldn't want to, but you can imagine him cycling along the canal, kind of seeing her from behind, small and petite, the kind of thing he likes. And when you turn to the side, he probably would have overtaken her at the side. He sees a similar type face. So, do you know, it was because obviously she's dead, he's dead. So he can't explain why he did it. He never left a note or anything like that. So obviously we're having to take a lot of this on face value. But the evidence does show that it wasn't premeditated to the point. I had to rewrite that in when we were editing this. I had to put, because premeditation can be across a year or it can be like a second. So if people say it wasn't premeditated, if you literally grab a knife, that is premeditated. So because you've put thought into it, it's not just an instant reaction. So but obviously, like as mentioned before, he had attacked a young girl who was 14-year-old in the Boston Manor Park, so he's got a bit of a thing for kind of very petite girls. Rudita, obviously, he met her in a nightclub. She was only very young at the time, but he was exactly what he was after. She fell pregnant very quickly. They got married in a small ceremony in Riga in December 1994. It's unclear whether he took her name at that point, because her name is Zalkins and he was a Daxa. But it's more than likely that he took it after he'd come out of prison. I've got a photo. There's a photo online about showing them getting married as well. She doesn't exactly look happy. Can you blame her? A lot of the information we get, it's slightly biased, but a lot of it's from Rudita's mother, Vittoria. She really hated Arnis. She really did. She said, "Once you have tasted blood, the taste stays. I never liked him. He was a control freak and had a temper all the time. At first my daughter said she'd been shot." This was the initial shooting, when he shot her in the stomach with the handmade handgun. First my daughter said she had been shot by a random guy in a motorbike. She was too scared to say it was Zalkins. She only told us a few months later. She didn't want to tell us or the police because she was scared of him, but less than a year later he killed her." Nasty piece of work, that man. As mentioned before, it was a low caliber gun, so he shot her, it went into her stomach, it pained against her spine. And obviously he refused to pay for a surgeon to have it removed, so the bullet stayed there, which is one of the ways they were able to identify her body when they later found her. There's not really a lot to tell you about the murder itself. I've kind of put it all in the episode itself. It was uncertain. He said, this was his confession, he said that she had been started, she'd started having a lesbian affair and going out with other women and taunting him with that. Rudita's mother said that's a complete lie. He was getting involved with drugs gangs and Latvia mafia. We don't really have evidence for that, but you know, something happened. Personally, I think he was just controlling. I think he just didn't like the fact that she was going out and enjoying herself and he wasn't allowed to be involved. So he made a cosh out of a bit of scaffolding pole. He cut it down. It's about a foot long. If you've steel or aluminium scaffolding poles are pretty tough, pretty horrible stuff. He also made an 8-inch knife with a handle with electrical tape on it. He had all of these in that location in Riga ready to kill. He had already pre-dug the grave. So I mean, this is why it's important to go back to this history, is to show you what his mind is like. He is a premeditator. He knows he wants to kill. He knows knows exactly what he wants to do. He's dug the grave. He knows he's going to kosh her. He knows he's going to stab her in the heart. He knows, and some of the similarities are here. Obviously, he doesn't just dump her in the ground. He strips her, then dumps her in the ground, then buries the clothes elsewhere. Do you know the similarities going on there? Again, a 3-foot grave. Here, Alice was buried 3 feet down as well. He put other stuff on top of the grave to kind of disguise it, and then he made it look so soil and leaves and rocks and things like that. Obviously, this is wooded ground, so it's easier to kind of hide it, but he disguised it so it was impossible for the police to find it, exactly as he did with Alice. I didn't mention this here, but he grabbed himself a bottle of vodka, started swigging as he stood over the grave, and then afterwards, he went to the police. If you notice, he did the same with Alice as well. He went to the corner shop and he picked up a couple of beers. I'll go into that very shortly. Her daughter, Vittoria, who was Rudita's mother, said Rudita, even though she was small, she could handle herself. You know, she was she'd spent years training to do karate. So even though she was little, you know, she's quite a tough cookie as well. But so it was a surprise attack from behind. Again, with Alice, surprise attack. Running, jogging along the canal, doesn't expect to be dragged. It's daylight. He would have put his hand over her mouth, silenced her, dragged her into the bushes. She would be terrified. So there's a lot of similarities here. We don't really mention much about Elvira, who was their child. So Rudita and Arnis's child was born 2 months after they were married. So by the age of kind of 1/2, if you think about it, that poor child didn't have a father because the father was in prison and the mother was dead. So the child had to go and live with the grandmother who was there, Vittoria, who I mentioned. There's a lot of fallout from that. Like Elvira's grandfather, I think she said a railway worker. He turned to drink and was later admitted to a psychiatric hospital. He died in 2003 at the age of 75. Elvira didn't know much about her mother and only started hearing stories about what had happened to her mother when she was about age 7, when the other kids in the playground started mentioning it, which is quite sad. Post-prison. So mentioned he went to prison. He was sentenced to 12 years. He served, it was reduced to 8, but he served 7. This is because he'd already done 1 year on remand. He was released. Believed at that point he took his wife's surname, which is why it's hard to kind of track him down. He was on probation at that point, so he was held under very supposedly strict probation conditions, but it doesn't seem to be that strict. Do you know, he was able to change his name, he started a new relationship, he moved to a different town, and then he moved out of the country. He was able to come to this country because Latvia had become part of the EU in 2003. I think their referendum was 03. Then I think it became EU country 04. Yes, and he was released in 05. He was able to come to the country not on a passport, but on using his national ID card. Obviously, on his ID card, it said Arnis Zalkins, not Arnis Daska. Therefore, he wasn't put on the Interpol's watch list either. Therefore, when he came into the country, he was just a regular guy. You know, we'll get into something about that very shortly. Came here, started a new relationship. So if you imagine it, he's already got one child in Latvia with the wife he's murdered, then with Liga Rubinowitz, I believe her name was, the second one, he got 2 children with her, and then he had had another child with his new girlfriend when he moved to the UK, Katerina Labelov, who he moved in with at Castlebar. So they just had a 1-year-old child, so he's got 4 children by that point. Jesus Christ, man, keep it in your pants. 2009, the dates on this are uncertain, but this is the sexual assault of the 14-year-old girl. He was arrested for it. It's indecently assaulting a 14-year-old girl. This was in Boston Manor Park. So he was living in Boston Manor at the time, which is, as mentioned before, a little suburb in West Ealing. It's just south of Hanwell. He was using the canal a lot on his bike. He said he would go along there quite a lot to go to work, but he'd also pick berries. He'd pick berries to make a slow gin. The indecent assault, there's very few details about this, as you can appreciate. She was only a young girl at the time. She didn't want her details in the press. It was quite a traumatic experience. She didn't want it to go any further. Do you know, it's understandable. She wouldn't want to have to go to court and have to face him again. And, you know, she's probably terrified. So she dropped the charges, put it behind her. Because of that, he was bailed. The police said at the time, there was no checks done on foreign convictions. That what it is now, but at that point they were not mandatory to do. But think about it, even if they had, he wouldn't have come up on the system because he was down as Arnest Zalkins, not Arnest Dasker, which is what his name was under. He wasn't on the Interpol watch list. And in Latvia anyway, on the ACRO system, there the Latvian policy is to... is to delete murder convictions after 8 years. After 8 years, that's absolutely disgraceful. So you'd think if someone was convicted of murder, it would be on their list. You know, shoplifting, not really a problem. Murder, might be worth keeping it on the list. Anyway, yep, the police went over to Latvia. By this point, this is Tuesday the 23rd of September. They'd already been over once before. I think they first went over on like the 10th of September. They'd already been working very closely with the Latvian police because they believed that he was possibly there. If he was to have fled, they thought he's fled to Latvia. Do you know, they knew he'd been missing from the 4th of September. So they were like, where is this man? He's not at work. His phone's off. He hasn't got his passport because that's still at home. But he can use his national ID card to get on a coach and go wherever he wants to in Europe. But he didn't seem to be using his credit cards, so they believed he was probably using cash. That's why they went to Latvia to try and find him. This was going to be problematic for them because at that point, 24th of September, they got enough pieces of evidence to... They'd already said, this is a key suspect. This is a person of interest. But the problem is they hadn't got enough to nail it down. They hadn't got the DNA, hadn't come back at that point. They hadn't found Alice's body. You know, there was a lot that they didn't know, but they knew they really suspected him in connection with her disappearance, and they wanted to talk to her. The problem was, if he had gone back to Latvia, because the police weren't in a position to charge him at that point, the Latvian police couldn't do anything about it. They couldn't detain him. They couldn't get an arrest warrant. So they were kind of in a really difficult situation. You know, if he'd fled, they were stuck. They just needed to keep going. And they did. If, as you can see, one of the largest manhunts in London history, the largest search since the 7/7 bombings. I mean, it was huge. But they kept trying. They kept plodding on. Let me just scroll down a bit. Thursday, 25th of September. I don't know if I mentioned this in episode one, but they did a second appeal. And they, oh yes, I did. They got a police cadet to come along who looked like her and to marry up the route that Alice would have taken. And they showed the footage of her crossing over that footbridge. It was also the same day that they confirmed that Arnis was not a person of interest, but a suspect. Commander Graham McNulty said Arnest Zalkins is a suspect in her disappearance. He is someone that we need to talk to. Two people have so far been arrested, which I mentioned, investigated and eliminated from this investigation. We don't know any more about those two guys. I kind of stumbled upon them when I was digging through everything, but that's all I know. Arnest Zalkins is one line in this fast-paced and ever-expanding investigation. I stress there is no evidence that Alice has come to harm. That's true. At that point, they hadn't found her. All they'd found was the bag. But we are clearly very concerned for her welfare. I would urge everyone to be cautious about speculating on the exact involvement of Arnest Zalkins or any other individual in relation to this investigation. It was a highly unusual step to name a suspect Yes. Oh, no, that's my writing there. Sorry, I'm reading someone else's as mine. Yeah, I mean, the police, even they admitted, normally they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't go, this is a person of interest, we're naming. Or normally they go, we're looking for a man who knew Alice or da-da-da-da, like that. But no, they named him because they knew they need to find him because he was missing. As mentioned, 30 September, Alice's body is discovered. There was a coroner's trial, an inquest into her death on Friday the 10th of October, at West London Coroner's Court. That was just a preliminary hearing. Same for Arnis Salkins. That was on Monday the 13th into his death. So obviously her death was an unlawful murder. His was death by suicide. Because he was dead, they couldn't posthumously charge him. So what they did, they had an inquest at the Royal Courts of Justice. This was happened on the 27th of June 2016, so actually not too long ago. It lasted for about 8 days. There was a jury of 8 men and 3 women. It was concluded that Alice's death was consistent with compression asphyxia, as mentioned. You got to feel really sorry for the family because they had to sit there through this whole thing and listen to all the information about what happened in the case. And, you know, it must have been really traumatic. So I'm having my tea. They learnt all about how Salkins was found. He was found in the park, as mentioned before. You know, no one could find him. The police had actually searched that area, but they couldn't find a body hanging in a tree. So that shows how dense the woodland would have been. Don't forget, if he's hanging from a tree, it doesn't necessarily mean that he's up high on a tree and he's high and he's dangling. You can strangle yourself in about a multitude of different ways. You can literally put something around your foot and something around your neck and then just pull. That can do it. You can hang from a foot. Not a foot. Well, you can hang from a foot. But you hang from a foot high. As long as you have something up and it's something's pulling against your neck, you know, you can kill yourself that way. You could be lying down. I mean, that's not hanging, but you can still asphyxiate yourself that way. So, yeah, I mean, he could have been slumped somewhere low amongst some bushes. So, yeah. What else was there? There's that coot again. That coot has been a pain in the arse throughout this record. I wish he'd say something different. He just says, meh, meh, all day long. Let me just see. There's quite an important thing that kind of came up after this, Alice's family were keen. Obviously, you know, we'd had that earlier case on here, Andrei Kanowski, the Polish kind of child rapist murderer from Acton. So that's not too far away. And then you've got this one. There's another case that may be coming to Murder Mile soon that I've had to move because it's too close to this one. And unfortunately, they're all in kind of West Ealing as well. Because this was time of the referendum and things like that on the EU and stuff like that, the parents quite rightly were worried that people were going to take this as a kind of an anti-EU thing and use this for their own political gain, going, oh, these bloody foreigners coming over here. So it was they made some really nice, I won't read them all, but they made some nice statements about the fact that, you know, the whole purpose about the EU is to let people come in and out. And yes, we have problems. Yes, you know, the things should have been done, and you know, there should be checks made all the time. But you know, Alice, weirdly, not long before she died, she'd actually wrote a little something for her school about the EU and the referendum, and her thoughts entirely were on it. I'm trying to find it as I'm writing it. Her thoughts on it were all kind of like, people should be allowed kind of the freedom of movement. They should be allowed to come to, people should be allowed to come to our country just as we go to their country. Do you know, we should be embracing each other's kind of cultures and styles and understanding. And do you know what, we have bad people in our own country as well as, you know, other countries as well. So, you know, you're going to get good people, you're going to get bad people, you're going to get ambivalent people. So, she was quite progressive in her thoughts. So her parents, of the same opinion, wanted to respect her wishes as well. And they went out of their way to say, we don't want you, the political parties, because it was around that time of the referendum when people were getting nasty. They were like, we don't want you using our dead daughter for your political gain. And, you know, some tossers like, you know, National Front and people like that, Britain First, were using it because oh, bloody foreigners. But, you know, they're just an insult to Alice's memory. I didn't put that in the episode because I didn't want it to turn into a rant. But it's out there. You can have a look at it. There were some a little mistake made in the investigation. Unfortunately, one of the coroners, I'm not too sure which one. Oh, well, I do know. I've got a name there, but I'm not going to mention it. Inverted commas, inadvertently disposed of a 30-page document on the evidence against chief suspect Arnis Salkins. The Metropolitan Police tried to recover the file but concluded it had probably been destroyed. It looks like it may have been left on a train. Embarrassing. So what else was there? And obviously mentioned in here, we've got Alice's funeral as well. So it was a private funeral at Hanwell Cemetery, which is not too far from the Uxbridge Road and near her home. It was a British humanist funeral. The first one was initially a private one. So the procession going through town with all the ribbons were there, and people, the cars stopped and people were hats off and things like that. And then it made its way to a private ceremony. On the car was, as mentioned, a small yellow coffin, brightly coloured designs by her sister, who was an aspiring artist. And all kind of things that she loved. So who was it? There was paintings of her three cats and their dog, which is painted by her grandmother, and a scene of a meadow, because obviously Alice loved nature and things like that. So that was a funeral. There was a reading of Surprised by Joy by Wordsworth. Flags were flown at half mast at Ealing Town Hall, which is just up the road. And then about a week later, there was a public memorial. There was a Greenford Town Hall. And as mentioned, there is the Alice's Youth Music Memorial Fund. If you want to support that, I think they've raised about £83,000, which is great, but it's always good to raise more. So if you want to, there's a link in the show notes to this and the previous episode as well. 27th of January 2015, it was announced that charges would have been brought against murder suspect Arnis Salkins if he had lived. The Crown Prosecution Service said that the case would have been based on circumstantial evidence, not forensic or eyewitnesses. So circumstantial, so not definite that he would have been definitely found guilty, but I think there's enough there. Anyway, that's out. I haven't even had my macaroon or my tea yet. Oh, this is one swig of tea. Right, this is going to be a long day because I am... I'm very behind after this eye infection, so I'm going to try and edit this in 2 days as opposed to three. Good luck. Right, that's me done. Hope you all enjoy that. Next week's is a single episode. There's a couple of doubles in here. There are going to be some doubles in this season. Why? Because some stories need to be told in two parts. They have to be. It's kind of, you know, I need to set something up there and then conclude it there. You're going to hate it. End of the year, there's an eight-parter. So, you know, there's a four-parter in here as well. So get used to it. That's all I'm going to say. Get used to it. Anyway, next week is a one-parter. So everyone can enjoy that one. Cool. That's me done. Oh, my nose is really dry. Because I spent 5 days blowing it. Ugh, horrible. Right, that's me done. No more talking about snotting and eye infections. More talking about macaroons. Anyway, that's good. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, be good, and hope to hear from you all soon. Be good. Bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news.
Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.